to lead us in prayer as we stand. So let's pray together. The writer of John's Gospel wrote this: "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory." And so we praise you, Father in heaven, that you have not hidden yourself away, that you have declared yourself once and for all time in history, that we can know you, and that we can see your glory. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Please sit down and allow me to thank you again very much indeed for coming to be with us, especially this is a first visit for you. As I say, we're really glad you've been able to join us. I do hope this will become a regular feature of your life on a Tuesday lunchtime. Every now and then we lay on a special talk like this where we pick up a particular aspect of the Christian faith and examine it, questions people might have, particular issues. And today we are looking specifically at the trustworthiness of the eyewitness account of John's Gospel. And we have Charlie Screen with us to speak for us. He's spoken before on the Gospels, and this time I've asked him specifically to address the issue of John's Gospel. Charlie read history at Oxford University. History is a passion of his. He says this is new material for him, so I'm really looking forward to it. We are guinea pigs, and Charlie, thank you very much. Charlie runs our student work here, usually, and he's very kindly come to join us this lunchtime. Now, I'm going to hand over to Sim Seema, who is an underwriter at Swiss Re, and he's going to read for us from the John's Gospel that you have there. And then it's over to Charlie Screen. Sim.
Okay, please take this small booklet you have in front of you. We're going to start on page 4, and you'll see the final sentence there. So this is John chapter 1, starting at verse 34. "And I have seen and borne witness that this is the Son of God." The next day, again, John was standing with two of his disciples, and he looked at Jesus as he walked by and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God." The two disciples heard him say this, and they followed Jesus. Jesus turned and saw them following and said to them, "What are you seeking?" And they said to him, "Rabbi," which means teacher, "where are you staying?" He said to them, "Come and you will see." So they came and saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him that day, for it was about the 10th hour. One of the two who heard John speak and followed Jesus was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He found his own brother Simon and said to him, "We have found the Messiah," which means the Christ. He brought him to Jesus. Jesus looked at him and said, "You are Simon, the son of John. You shall be called Cephas," which means Peter. The next day, Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." Jesus saw Nathanael coming towards him and said of him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" Jesus answered him, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Nathanael answered him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus answered him, "Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree. Do you believe? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man."
Sim, thank you very much. And thank you, William, for inviting me to come and speak on this. I'm very glad to have the opportunity to speak on it, to do some reading, a little bit of reading up on John's Gospel, because I knew it less well. If you were at the previous talk I did here on the New Testament Gospels, I'm going to try and repeat very little of what we said then. I think you'll be relieved by that. You may, though, if you weren't here, want to get hold of at least the handout, which is on our website, to find out what we did say there. This handout is well under half the length, which you may think is a good thing, but it is a new talk, so I'm less good at knowing what to leave out. So we'll see how we go, and the watch is on the lectern here. So you've been looking at John's Gospel Tuesday by Tuesday here, but what is it? What are you reading as you read it? And I've put the first thing on the handout, a quote from Professor Richard Dawkins, because he is fun to read and because he puts down in writing what lots of people I meet believe. And here's what he believes. Ever since the 19th century, scholarly theologians have made an overwhelming case that the Gospels are not reliable accounts of what happened in the real world. And that is partly true. You only need to change two words to make that true. You take out the words ever since, and you put instead the word in. So in the 19th century, that is what they thought. I've put an example, two men, one a man called Bauer, who dated John's Gospel to 170 AD, or later even, and then a man called Strauss, who said this is almost entirely myth. So Richard Dawkins is right. In the 19th century, that is what people thought about this book. And their reasons for that included things like, do you see how developed John's ideas are? I don't know if you've noticed that, reading through it, how different it is to Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They said how developed his ideas are. They must be very late ideas. They said, look how Greek his ideas are and how Gnostic his ideas are. Therefore, they can only be very late. And they pointed to the archaeology and geographical information they had available and said, John gets it all wrong. He must be very late. Now, as we evaluate that claim, which is what Richard Dawkins still thinks and lots of people I meet, what they still think, we need just to say a little bit about how you work out the date and authorship of an old book. And here we're in very, very normal questions. This is what we spent quite a long time on in the talk I did here before, so I'm not going to do lots on comparing these books with other ancient books. All I want to say now is just everything we're going to do in terms of history and evidence is entirely normal. Who wrote it? We're not entirely sure because we haven't got the original. That's normal. What did other people say about it, and did they get it right? That's normal. Have we got a copy, or have we got the original? That's normal. And in general, the New Testament documents do far, far better than all of their equivalents, simply because the New Testament was the most popular book of those early centuries. So we have more copies and more bits and more pieces. Please look that up on the website if you want more of that. And broadly what you do is you look at the internal evidence, what's in the book, what does that make you think? And you look at the external evidence. What does what we find out elsewhere make us think about this book? And that's what we're going to do. And in particular, on dating, what you're looking for is brackets. When can this book not be earlier than? So 33 AD, when Jesus was doing his stuff. That's a good date. It can't be earlier than that. It can't possibly be earlier. And then a latest possible date, well, you're looking for the first time it was quoted or something like that. And you're trying to squeeze those dates together to try and end up where it was written. So then on internal evidence, it looks as if this is a book by an eyewitness. And the recent scholarly work to read on that is by a man called Richard Baucom, who is professor of New Testament in St. Andrews. I think he may have just retired. Major, major work on the Gospels. And he says the best way to understand the Gospels is that they are what they present themselves as the work of eyewitnesses. He says just because they don't fit the conventions of modern history or modern biography doesn't mean they are loose about facts or fictional. He says in their own categories, compare them to similar books of the time, and they fit the category of history rather than the category of fiction. These are eyewitnesses, that's the sort of history word, and they are testimony, that's the law court word. And they fit the kind of conventions of their day, the equivalent of footnotes and bibliography in their day. And in John, it's very clear that is the author's own claim. It's anonymous, the book, Says it's by someone called the disciple Jesus loved. He keeps appearing in the book. But again, in the time, that needn't be a problem. And it's clear the first audience were meant to understand who that was. So I've put some references on the sheet. John 1, saying something bizarre happened. The word became flesh and we saw it. Were the people who saw somebody the day that God became a human being. The end of the book, 20, 30 and 31, tells you the aim of the book and what he thinks he's done. He thinks he's given you reasons to decide that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of God. And he thinks you should take him seriously because of what it says in chapter 15, chapter 19 and chapter 21. He is someone who saw it all. He was there from the beginning. He can be a witness. Technical law court word. And chapter 21 ends with a group of other people saying, we know the bloke who wrote this, and we know that you can trust him. And should say, this is in the book stressed, he's not just an eyewitness, he is an unusually privileged, particularly good one, who you should really trust to have known what was going on. And that's at the bottom of the first page there. He was a best friend to Jesus, the one Jesus loved, the one that Jesus said, will you look after my mum? Once I've gone, that close a friend. He's in a top table position at the events that happen in chapter 13. Peter has to ask John, you know, will you just nudge Jesus and ask him what's going on here? John's that close. He has close access. Possibly it's him in chapter 18 who can go deeper into the high priest's house than Peter can because he's got the connections and the man on the inside. Chapter 19, he's the only male disciple at the cross because all the other men had run away. There's plenty of women there, but all the men had run away. He is, chapter 20, the first man to the empty tomb, though he's too chicken to go inside until Peter arrives. And in chapter 21, he's one of a small group of disciples who go fishing to make themselves feel better afterwards. And he's the one who says, that's Jesus, when they see a man on the shore. And he's one of just two, John and Peter, himself and Peter, who Jesus has a particular, this is what you're going to do after I'm gone, word for. So he's very close to the events. And he is possibly, just turn to chapter 21 at the very back, he is possibly a bit of an old codger by the time he writes the book. That's not the technical theological word for it. So chapter 21, verse 23 on the last page. There's a saying that spreads among Christians that this disciple, the author, was never going to die, not to die until Jesus came back. And the writer has to explain, or the kind of his mates have to explain, that isn't actually what Jesus said. So maybe he's old, and you'll see why we need that later. Certainly he lives longer than Peter. There are then lots of other things we might deduce internally that the author isn't stressing, but that things like what is he interested in, what background is he from, who might he have been writing for? That's the internal evidence. Then the external evidence is quite fun. So remember, we're dealing with Richard Dawkins saying ever since the 19th century, people have said this is a late book and nobody knows. You can say that. Well, you could say that. We know for certain that Bauer and Strauss were wrong because in 1920, somebody found a little piece of manuscript. And it's in Manchester on display now if you want to go and see it. And a man called Colin Roberts published and translated it in 1934. And it is a bit of John's Gospel. And it comes from about 125 AD. And I hope, you know, even the sleepy ones here today can see what that does to that it was written in 170 AD theory. If we have a bit from earlier, it can't have been. And more than that, that copy, that little fragment, is not a first edition. It is clearly a copy, and a copy in the place where the original was not written. So we must be going back considerably before 125 AD to the point when John wrote it. So that is what I'm going to call a sort of hard fact, in terms of it just puts an end date on. So we've got 33 AD at the beginning, before 125 AD at the other end. Then, as well as that discovery, there has been over the 20th century a re-evaluation of the earliest evidence and uses of John. So, for instance, people began saying, oh, look, John's Gospel is quoted and used by a bunch of heretics in the 2nd century. And this was the sort of standard answer in the 1940s to the 1980s, was that John's Gospel was only really popular with the heretics and the weirdos. And it is only in 180 AD that a kind of proper Christian called Irenaeus, he's number C on that list there, he grabs hold of John's gospel and makes it mainstream for the first time. So I've put on there the heretics who quote it. There's a guy called Ptolemaeus who uses it and says it is an apostolic book by an apostle. And there's a guy called Heracleion who writes the first commentary on John's gospel. But more recently, people have been reevaluating whether it was just the heretics and the weirdos who used John. And in particular, one reevaluation was a book by Tatian, which is something I guess lots of us have wished existed, which is an attempt to tell the kind of the story of Jesus in order, in a way that pulls together all the four Gospels and puts them in order. So Tatian is in Rome in about 160, 170, and he does that, and he does it with the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and only those four Gospels, which is very significant if you read or watched the Dan Brown idea, that there were maybe 80 Gospels running around and who knows which ones we should choose. He puts them in order, he uses those four and those no other ones. But recently people have been doing some work on his book and have said, actually, do you notice he doesn't just use John, he puts John in prime place. And he's noticed that Matthew, Mark and Luke, their chronology doesn't always agree with John, which you notice pretty quickly when you read the Gospels. And he says that is because John is the one closest to the action, who cares most about the history of it, and John's is the one with the kind of accurate order. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke have felt free to shuffle stuff around to make points when they wanted to. So it's not just a gospel he knows, it's the gospel he knows. And also, people have been doing work on him and saying, where does he get this idea? Because he goes a bit weirdo and heretical later in his life as well. And they've come down on the idea he gets it from a guy called Justin Martyr and the absolutely mainstream of Christianity in Rome in the 150s. So that this is what they thought in 150 AD in Rome about the Gospel of John. Then there was Irenaeus, who definitely quotes from it. But is he unusual? And there have been new research saying no. And in particular, this book I'm going to go here. And for this, could you just turn to the, look at the bottom of the third page I've got there. And there's a book list there. I just want to explain what those books are. So I've put on there a book on the whole gospel by Don Carson, which would be the book I'd recommend you to get and buy if you want a book to help you read and understand John's gospel. It's a really good commentary on John. And it happens to have in it as well probably 20, 30 pages on what we're talking about today. That's a good survey and a good summary of that. But if you buy that book, you need to know that Don Carson is a conservative and a committed Christian, and he's writing to try and prove that John's gospel was written by John the Apostle and written early enough for it really to have been him. So this is not the book that kind of the secular academy feels they have to engage with if they're going to try and work out when John wrote. This is by a kind of fan of John putting that case, but it's a good accessible place to read. Whereas this book that I mentioned, this is the kind of book the Academy is going to have to engage with if they want to go on saying John's gospel isn't eyewitness material. It's been well reviewed, well received. It's by an expert in the field. This is the kind of big heavyweight book to read. Then this book I'm talking about now is a much more recent book, 2010. It's a collection of other books. And the article I'm about to talk about is by a guy called Charles Hill. Because it is a recent book, it is dangerous to kind of throw that out as if everybody agrees with it. It's too early to know what people will make of this. And Charles Hill himself is working in a conservative institution. But this book is the major gathering of what people thought about John's gospel in the second century. It's a kind of big collection published by a very well-respected scholarly journal. This would be the place to go to see what do you think about John in the second century. Okay, so that's, and the last one in there is a list of videos. If big heavy books aren't your thing, there's some videos there. If you can stand Australian accents and American accents, then you'll find some useful videos on there, I think. So come back to other people quoting it. The guy in here, Charles Hill, he says he has found 22 mainstream proper Christians from the second century who are all using John's gospel. And by using, he means they've read a written copy of John's gospel. They're not just remembering the same sort of stories that John worked on, and that they see it as authoritative. So the two things we'd want. I'm not qualified to evaluate what he's written. You'd need to kind of work out from other books that will appear in the next 10 years what they make of it. But he's quoting big, big figures, Justin Martyr, Papias, Polycarp and Ignatius, using John writing about it. Okay, I need to move on. It's also in the second century ascribed to John, as in if you open up anything anybody wrote in the 100 years after the book was written and say who wrote it, they all say John, with the exception of some two to the late heretics in the late second century. They say it was John. So all of them agreeing by John in Ephesus and a guy who lived to a big old age. Then you can check it with archaeology. I think I mentioned this last time. There was a bit in John 5, there's a pool that was meant to be a really classic example of John just inventing stuff because he'd never been to Jerusalem. It was destroyed in 70 AD. You can say that until we find it. And then suddenly that flips around and is evidence that John must have known Jerusalem, the city that was destroyed in 70 AD, and cannot possibly have been inventing this lots later. But actually, more important, you can use archaeology as context for the book. Do you remember people said it must be late because it's Greek, it's Gnostic, and the ideas in it are late? That's an all right thing to say, while we know almost nothing about what people of the time thought and said. But 1945, we find an enormous library of the Gnostics, so suddenly we know a lot about what Gnostics thought. Turns out they're not all Greek, they're not all late, some of them are Jewish. And then we find a big library, the Dead Sea Scrolls, in 1947, of a kind of, imagine a sort of a Jewish monastery. So we'd suddenly know a lot about what Jewish people thought in the right period. And it turns out, actually, Gnosticism has Jewish roots, and Jewish people can write stuff about light and darkness and life and death and big ideas. That's not unusual. And also we understand Galilee a lot more. Turns out the Galileans were not the hicks from the villages. They are a major trading area with multicultural, multilingual links all over the Mediterranean and certainly into Jerusalem. Which means suddenly there's no reason why a Jewish contemporary of Jesus from Galilee could not have been writing this book with these ideas in Greek in the time when people said he did. So the current consensus now has moved from 170 AD down to between 90 and 100 AD. And I wanted to check I got that absolutely right, and I was having lunch with a theology undergraduate from Oxford last week. She sent me her essay. She's gone for 90 AD as a kind of plum consensus date in there. And on date, that may feel very late still, 90 to 100 AD. But remember, that what we've done there is we've gone with the hard facts. Must be earlier than 125 AD, must be later than 33, and all the early evidence in the second century by John the Apostle. And basically what the consensus have done is says, right, we'll go for the latest possible date off that evidence. And they've done that for what you might call soft fact reasons. So they see things in it that make them think it's probably the latest of the four Gospels. And still this idea that the ideas are advanced. So 90 to 100 AD is the kind of the consensus date now, though it is a latest possible date. But there is no consensus about who wrote it. So this guy says it was Thomas. Baucom thinks it was another John, a different John who also knew Jesus. These guys sit very firmly on the fence. She says it was John's mates. And Don Carson says it was John the Apostle. And the reasons get massively complicated and involved, and I don't want to bore you too much. In fact, we have no time to bore you at all. This guy has a list of 21 reasons that includes excellent stuff like fish don't come up very much in the book if he was a fisherman. And stuff like, but John hates Samaritans, but his gospel's quite nice about them. Think, do you not really think he might have changed his mind over 30, 40 years, having seen Jesus be nice to Samaritans and seen Samaritans join the church with him alongside Gentiles who he probably hated much more? So that, there's that kind of species of reasons. And in particular on dating, I don't buy one of the big assumptions, which is that an old person cannot have written this book. I think that the most boring thing I ever did in my history degree was a history and statistics module. It was so dull, I taught myself to write with my left hand during the lectures. But basically, the sort of working out life expectancy is quite difficult and complicated. So average life expectancy doesn't tell you sort of median or deviation of life expectancy. Loads of people died in infancy very young. And what actually matters is how medical technology is at the point at which you first need it. And we can do quite a good example of that in this room, because William's predecessor was born in 1925, Dick Lucas, born in 1925. As it happens, a member of my family was also born in 1925. And the key thing is, when did they first need medical attention? So the member of my family first needed medical attention in 1975. And as it happens, sadly, he had a disease we still don't know how to cure. He died in 1977, could not possibly have been writing a book in his 80s. But Dick, I've put his dates on there alongside. So the 35 AD, let's say John was 20. 85 AD, John would be 70. Dick Lucas, born in 1925, means that in 1995, he was 70, when he wrote the only book that I have belonging to him. And if you heard Dick speak this summer, I imagine Dick would be pretty offended if you said, oh, I don't think you could possibly write a 27-page book now that you're so doddery, in 2012. There is no particular reason John could not have lived late and written this book, and lots of reasons actually you might want to stick it earlier. I just want to close with something on how you read eyewitness material. So that's what I'm arguing this is. It is eyewitness material. There's good reasons to think that, even if the scholarly consensus isn't yet on quite who wrote it. I think you read eyewitness material the way that it is intending to be read. So if something is myth, you don't pay any attention to the facts. I've been reading the story of Pinocchio to my son, discovered to my joy it includes lots of stuff on how you must obey your parents. So I've been kind of slowing down, let's pay attention to this, Tom, but I've not been encouraging him to think Pinocchio was real. Or some things have symbolic content. So not so long ago, not very far from here, I listened to some people telling me a story that involved darkness and involved water and involved alcohol and involved life and death, lots of the themes that come up in John's Gospel. Was that a symbolic story? Did they want me to go from there and draw from the story, I must unshackle myself from darkness, tie off the ropes and drift out into the Thames? No, because I was in the Old Bailey on a jury, and sadly we were hearing the story of how a man called Jay Murillo, one night when it was dark, because he was drunk and because a boat was not tied on properly, stepped over the edge, fell in the water and drowned. And the people speaking intended to be taken as eyewitnesses, not as symbolism or as deeper meaning. And all of the questions that you'd normally ask of an eyewitness come up, and we use them all. So are you saying that because you're his best mate? Are you saying that because you're his old teacher? Are you saying that because you're the officious man from the government bureaucracy who wants Thames boats tightened down on? And those, which I put the Richard Dawkins quote on there, just because that is how to read, isn't it? Dawkins says that people only believe the Bible if they don't ask those questions. On the contrary, that is what Christians have been asking about these eyewitness materials for centuries. It's what you must ask. I don't think we have time. I was going to point out that chapter 1 and chapter 20, the beginning and the end of the book, deliberately set up the apostles and the writer of this in particular as your commission of inquiry, which is the thing we always ask for. When there's things we want to know the truth of, we say, let's set up a commission of inquiry and examine everything. And again, this was a happy find last week. This, I think, is the most boring book in the world. This is the report of the panel of inquiry on the Greater London Council plan to change London in the 1970s. And this isn't even the report. This is volume 2, the appendices. I picked it up for 50p. I think it is the most boring book in the world. And that is the sort of thing we'd want on a tricky thing like that. Someone who will read everything, look into everything, so that we can read it and decide what we think. And that is precisely what John and his friends say they have done. We have seen it, we have witnessed it, so that you can read it and you can decide what you think. So just on the back of the handout, I'd really encourage you to either go for that guided read-through of John's Gospel or to go for the Christianity Explored course, the chance to do that, actually with a different gospel, but with a group of people, and to bring all the hard questions you'd bring to an eyewitness, but not the ludicrous, outdated skepticism of Richard Dawkins to these books. Thank you. Good, can I interrupt? There are lots of questions here. What Wes hasn't told me is when we need to stop. Do you want to give me a 5 minutes? Okay, so I will go quite quickly. As Christians, by questioning, are we saying we don't believe? How does questioning sit against faith. Turn to John 20, and I think I can give you John's answer to that, which is handy. That was something else I was going to put in the talk, but we ran out of time for. So the character of Thomas in John's Gospel, is he a good example of faith or a bad example? So they say to John, we've seen the Lord, he's alive again. And John says exactly what you'd want someone on your panel of inquiry to say. He says, unless I see the hands, in his hands the mark of the nails, place my finger into the mark of the nails, place my hand into his side, I will never believe. Which again, is exact. That's the most skeptical you could be. I want to see it for myself, prod, and find out. And then, 8 days later, Jesus leaves him stewing for 8 days. Jesus comes and says, hello, here I am. Put your hands wherever you want. Here I am. You can check it's true. And John says, I see and I believe. But then, he is used as an example to push us. So Jesus says to him, have you believed, bottom of page 59, have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. And immediately after it says, this book is written so that you could believe. And I think the point is, it's right to ask critical questions. Absolutely right. People who, my friends think that Christians believe in blind faith. And my friends think that sort of proof would damage faith. None of that is the New Testament understanding. Faith is a response to evidence. It's an appropriate response to evidence. It's putting your trust in evidence given to you. The problem with Thomas is he is given lots of evidence. His 10 friends who he knows really well say, we have seen Jesus alive again. Eyewitness, we saw it, it's changed our lives, it's definitely true. And he completely discounts their evidence. Whereas what John is suggesting is that you take that kind of evidence seriously. Ask questions about it, by all means, please do the Dawkins kind of questions, but take it seriously and come to an evidence-based decision. So yes, questions, but I just think we make decisions like that all the time. Who will I marry? And that is an entirely non-proof-based thing. I have no idea whether my wife, still after 11 years, is an axe murderer or not. I can't prove that, but I know a lot about her. I've known her for 25 years. I think I'm pretty sure she's not. It's that sort of thing. You make a faith decision based on the evidence you have. Then a question going the other way. Why won't more people take the gospel seriously if it is true and reliable? I think I want to separate those three categories. So increasingly, people are taking the gospel seriously as something reliable, but that is different from saying it is true. So again, please, all I'm trying to persuade you of today, that this is serious, reliable eyewitness material. That doesn't say anything about its truthfulness. Could be serious and eyewitness, but fictional. It's kind of lying. Sorry, not fictional. I want to say it's not fictional, but it could be lying. Could be trying to present you with historical data that is made up in order to persuade you. And that's where you need to think, why are they saying this? Who did he persuade at the time? How well did they know the events of Jesus? Why was he able to persuade lots of people to accept this if it's not true? So increasingly, scholars are taking it seriously, but that doesn't necessarily mean they think it is true. Specific question about Richard Dawkins on that. Has he been prepared to engage on these issues since the God delusion? If not, why? Richard Dawkins tends not to engage with Christians because he says that will just give credibility to their nutcase views. He has done one or two debates, which I think you can buy, one with Richard Lane Craig, and that I'd recommend you see. On this issue, I haven't brought him with me, sorry. On this issue, it's just painfully obvious he is speaking outside of his specialty. So you look at his pages on the Bible, he does 6 pages only, and you read his bibliography of what he's read, and he has entirely read his mates, who say, Jesus never existed, it's all made up, da-da-da-da-da. He's clearly not bothered to walk down the corridor in his Oxford college to speak to even a very liberal, hostile theologian and say, what should I read on the dating of the Gospels? So I just think he's not in a position, he's a biologist. You can take him seriously on biology if you want, you can debate with him on that, but he's just not, he doesn't know what he's talking about here. And I think that's painfully obvious. How can we be confident that John's memory served him well? I struggle to remember what happened in my life even 10 years ago. I think there's 2 questions there. One is, when did John first start telling these stories? So I think that's right. If I sat you down, sometimes the police do this, don't they, and say, where were you on the afternoon of November the 10th, 1993? And I think probably we'd all struggle, wouldn't we? But if I said, let's take you back. So let's say my case, take you back to when my son was being born. You know, are you sure it was really him? Yes, I am. Or actually, what we're talking about here is a death. So a good friend of John's publicly executed while John stood at the foot of the cross. Do you think he died? Are you sure? John would say, yeah, I remember the blood pouring out of his sight. That's an eyewitness detail. You're not confused about that. Maybe it was just, you know, his sun cream or something. He's not confused. So I think, yes, minor details that might have been forgotten, but these are big, major, life-changing events. The blood poured out of his side one day. A week or so later, he was barbecuing fish for me. He's not confused about those events. And they start telling these stories from day one. So these are more like the story you tell every time you meet the same group of friends than something that 50 years later you thought, oh, I wonder what happened, and I'll write it up. Question here about miracles. Jesus makes unique claims with outstanding signs, but don't other people like Sai Baba also do amazing signs? Why believe John over Baba's disciples? I don't know if you know about Sai Baba. I have a cousin who is very, very into him, who travels to India to see him. He's a sort of guru figure who does miracles. My cousin showed me a photo. I think it's a copy of a photo that allegedly Sai Baba had kind of, and it's a different photo. That sort of thing, those sort of signs. I think it's a good question, and it puts you in the right place where John wants you as you read his book. So what kind of signs does John do? How publicly verifiable are they? And how else do you explain the stories about him? So Jesus, for instance, is killed publicly. There were some magicians on TV a couple of years ago who did a reenactment of Jesus' miracles, showing how you could do them with modern television and modern technology. But here's the one they didn't do. Let's take you, arrest you, hand you over to a third-party foreign power who are allowed to kill you in whatever way they want, do whatever they want with your body, and then 3 days after that, after receiving no medical attention, you have to reappear and convince us that you are the Lord of life. It's that level of miracle. It's the man who has been all of his life blind and whose healing causes a major court case in the whole town. That kind of stir. Public, verifiable. You know, this is definitely the same man. He definitely can see now. Look at him walk up and downstairs. I'm not an expert on Sai Baba, but I, from hearing to my cousin, I think we're in a different category of event there. Wes is trying to stand up. Can you explain Gnostic? Gnostic is stuff like John 14:11, the Father is in me and I'm in the Father. Gnostics believe everybody's connected to the spiritual wonderfulness of everything. I did Christianity Explored with a Gnostic guy who loved John's Gospel. And I think partly because he didn't read it in its Jewish background. Is the Gospel writer the same person who 1, 2 and 3 John? I think so. Not everybody does. There are very strong similarities. How do you know the AD 125 manuscript was a copy? They're working on where was it written, which, we've got lots of copies, which ones is it like? Is it like the what we think the most original one, or has it changed? Where's the handwriting? What's it written on? Where did we find it? There's a whole science of how you work those things out. Are you due to stop me? Sorry. Let me just finally, the thing, I don't know if Wes is going to say this, on the back of the sheets there, you've got two recommendations which I think would be excellent. One is to read John's Gospel with a friend, so as to just read it through and think, what do I make of this? The other would be to do Christianity Explored, or obviously keep coming here to hear John's Gospel and ask those kind of questions of it. Thanks, Wes.